was thought to have a ceiling of 16,000 feet. In order to land, pick up anybody, it would have to not only land, but take off at 17,300 feet. So Link Luckett started the helicopter, took the battery out of the helicopter, went light on fuel, threw all his emergency gear out, and while I was coming to Talkeetna with help of Bating, he relayed the John Day Expedition of Four down to the 14,300 foot level, and with a helicopter you always have a fuel problem, and he was going light on fuel. Anyway, I picked up three of the four of the John Day Expedition, including John Day himself, who was most seriously injured. I think it was a broken arm and a broken leg, as I recall. And he was properly split, and I stopped him aboard, and I brought him direct to Calcutta. Link Luckett went on record as having proved that this huge helicopter could climb and hover and take off at 17,300 feet.
Where was he from, Don Anchorage?
Louisiana. Well, he was based out of Anchorage, I think, for Anchorage helicopters.
Well, Anchorage helicopters.
I think so.
And they had the new machine there.
Yeah, right. It was their machine. But he risked it for it.
Yeah.
And anyway, that gets the four of the John Day Expedition off the mountain. It gets Helga Bating off the mountain. Also, the helicopters had landed a considerable amount of people in bad weather at 10,200 foot pass at an altitude they didn't think they could get their old Sikorskis up to. But nevertheless, they negotiated to 10,200 foot level, and I haul a total of 18 people out of this 14,200 foot level in a period of from 3 o'clock one morning until about noon the next day, with about a 2-hour break from midnight till 2 the following evening. But anyway, the mountaineers, the rescue groups that were climbing up from 10,000 to 14,300 feet, naturally their mission had been accomplished by the airplane, so they needed an airlift out. So as I say, I hauled Helga Bating, three of the John Day Expedition, that's four, and 14 rescue climbers back to the 10,200 foot level, the Lima Pass, in this particular period. It was about a 34-hour period with 2 hours of darkness for sleeping. And a tremendous effort was spent, the Army, the Air Force, the Coast Guard, all of the powers were flying cover and putting the burn on the rescue effort to see if they could get the people out of there. The ones that were lost were Elliot and Stevenson, the two in the 180 Cessna that burned as it crashed at 17,000 feet on the west coast. But that was the highest landing ever made on McKinley.
You never did get the, obviously, you never got anything back from the crash.
Right. Yeah, well, but the thing is, that undoubtedly, I use the place every year. I hauled them in Chico Sequita Expedition from there this summer. Last year, a year ago, I brought out Jattinger. Jattinger was a fine athlete from the Anchorage area, and probably 22 years old, thereabouts. And there was a crew of five, and they successfully climbed McKinley West Approach. Wait a minute. No, they were at the 16,000 foot level when Jattinger fell. That's the way it was. They didn't get up. The bad weather held him. Okay? He fell about to the end of his rope, which is 150 something feet. a fractured arm and possible concussions and jaw fracture. And we were in radio contact with the Jettinger expedition through the Institute of Arctic Biology that had a communication set up there.
Now this is happening after this three-part rescue.
Yeah.
This Jettinger.
Well, I'm just going into two summers ago.
Well, this is another story.
This is a different tale. Okay. This is the Jettinger expedition. I only mention it to point out the fact that I use this 14,300 foot elevation every summer. It's the highest radio controlled airport in the whole world, I think. Because this is higher than the mountains of Switzerland. This is a place good to pick up for emergency location. I took a Sedan, a great skier. I took one of his members sick with altitude sickness there this last summer. And also several other people, including Watanabe, one of Michiko Sakita's party members' husbands, and also Michiko Sakita, all here out of there, plus her two party members that fell. 19,000 foot level to the 15,000, fell 4,000 feet. They use it as a pickup plane. And anyway, getting back to the Jettinger tale, it was interesting because his own party took Jettinger up to 17,000 feet where there was an ice cave. And I told them before they did it, they would lose him, which they did. They said he's too sick to move. Well, I said, don't take him up, bring him down to where he can get a chance to breathe some oxygen. But they took him to the ice cave. Within hours, he developed pneumonia, altitude, pulmonary edema. Then they started to bring him down at dawn the next morning, and they lost him at about 15,000 foot level.
Why would they do that, Doctor? You think they'd know better?
I told him to get him down there at 14.3, and the weather was good enough, and I picked him up right within 2 hours. But no, they had to take
him. You'd think pulmonary edema would be an old friend of theirs. I mean, you'd think they'd know all about it.
Yeah. Well,
hard to understand.
Anyway, they panicked. Anyway, the weather went 8, slowed 5 or 6 feet, and the parents were wild, absolutely wild. To get him out, the rescue's not interested, unless there's a live victim, you see. They're not interested only in live victims. Anyway, so, I told the parents that Janae'd help me, I'd try. Now he's a place where it's impossible for a helicopter to pick up. So as the weather cleared, another crew that I had, the outward bound crew, it's a rescue group also, crew of five of the toughest, came by, saw Jettinger at the 15,500 foot level, tied with pitons into the ice, and the crew had vacated the mountain in the storm. So they let him down another 1,000 feet to the 14,700 foot level, and another storm hit for a day and a half, and they abandoned him. And so then his parents are absolutely wild, just wild, to get him out. So
Where were you from originally?
Anchorage. So Janae and I went up there, and we landed in 6 feet of fresh snow at 14,300 feet. And we ran for 7 hours to beat down the snow to attempt to take off. Late in the afternoon, the tremendous winds came up and nearly blew the plane over the south face of McKinley. And I elected the takeoff since it was a headwind and made it. And then I was in radio contact with old Janae. 2 hours later, he called on the radio and said, hey, I got him up to 14.3. I thought Janae crashed into a snowbank after running for 7 hours at 14,000 feet. Beat the runway down. He'd lap me about three times every one turnaround trip I make up and down 2,200 feet. And he said he got him up there alone. And what he did was get Janae, got Jettinger, bodily drug, a mile and a half laterally. And from where he was, he had to take him 14.8 down to about 14.1, and then back up to 14.3 and a lateral mile over a whole bunch of ice up to where I could load him on the plane to effect the takeoff in 2 hours, two more hours. And so in the morning at 4 o'clock, the phone rings, and it's a phone patch. Janae says, the weather's good, come on in, get him. And so I went in, and the mountain socked in, and I couldn't get close to it. And no sooner I got back to Talkeetna, and called again, he said, the wind blew it away, come on in. I say, what kind of wind? Oh, he says, it's gusting. Well, I say, suppose we just wait till the wind goes down so I can make a landing without getting blown off that mother up there.
Yeah.
And he said, well, it's getting calm. In about 10 minutes, he called again. He said, hey, it's calm now, come on in.
Yeah.
So I went on in and loaded Jettinger up and brought him to Talkeetna, turned right around, went back after Janae, and the wind blew the clouds and a big storm back over 14 level. So I came back here, took Janae to, took Jettinger to Anchorage, and so he wouldn't be laying around the hangar. And no sooner got back than Janae called up and said, hey, snow quit, snowed another foot, come on in, the weather's fine, no wind. I went in there and we tromped another 4 hours on another fresh foot of snow. And then I effected a relay takeoff of supplies, which I put at the 7,000 level. I duplicated two freight trips to the 7,000 foot level. Then that was now into the late afternoon, snow condition getting better. And snow crystallizing, I was able to take off with Janae in about 300 pounds in the face of a light west wind due to the grade of the glacier and the snow. But then we had to fly clear to Farewell to get back to Talkeetna because this whole area erupted in a tremendous overcast and heavy thunderstorms. So we nearly ran out of fuel going over by Farewell to get under the overcast to come back to Talkeetna. Okay, snap her off there.
Listen, I'm going to let it run for a minute. I got a couple questions here. That's not done, I thought. First of all, when you're tooling around up there, any one of these given jobs with your plane, well, first of all, on this three-way rest stage, what kind of plane?
Well, it was a 150 Super Cup, finely tuned. Yeah, it absolutely timed in mint condition. And the reason is that if the plane is not finely tuned, it won't develop even half its horsepower at altitude. And if you want to take off at sea level at half power, try it sometime. You won't make it off the ground. The reason you make it up there is for two reasons. One of them is hopefully the configuration of what you land on, which is a steep grade. And the other is the density altitude. And that's the altitude gives you, in cold air, a more favorable altitude, absolute, than it would in hot air. So if you're at 14,300 feet and the temperature's cold, you have a favorable, hopefully, 12 or 13,000 foot actual altitude, which makes the air 1,000 or so feet thicker. But it's still a hairy operation.
Well, look at when you're using oxygen up there now, what type of rig do you use? Are your face mask?
Well, I have three outfits. I've got a Scott, I have two Air Force rigs I use. But I shot so many landings up at 14.3, I know that I don't need oxygen up there.
Well, in other words, you weren't using oxygen.
Well, as I come over the top of 22,000 on McKinley when I first spotted the wreckage, I certainly was.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And what type were you using?
Scott.
It's a regular face mask.
2 hours, 18 minutes for two.
Portable. Does that interfere with your plan?
Well, no, but, well, it's a little inconvenient. But at least without it, you can fly at all.
Oh, yeah, you can fly, obviously. But I mean, what I meant was your vision and so forth.
It don't get in the way of your vision. Your glasses don't fit over your mask very well.
Yeah, right.
But you can make it all right.
How about the cabin temperature?
Well, you have your cabin heat.
Yeah, right, but I mean...
Your inside heat and outside heat would be the same if you left the cabin heater on, see?
I know,
That's right.
How about when you're flying up there looking down, just cruising around looking and so forth, and getting yourself oriented? What kind of bank angle do you use?
Well, you need a gradual angle, right?
You
don't want to reef it around up there.
And normally, is there a lot of turbulence up there? I mean,
if there's a lot of turbulence, you have no business up there.
Well, right, but I mean, under normal conditions, what would you say the turbulence is under what average conditions up there when you're up here on one of these trips?
I don't go up there if I can help it. If I know that there's shear zone turbulence, clear air turbulence, or pressure exchange velocities in the area, you can tell that by looking at the mountains.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Because you can see the wind, the mare's tail's coming off the top of McKinley, that's a good time to stay away from it. Well, they don't always tell you everything either. They do in some cases, but you can also get the winds aloft charts up above 20,000 feet and all through the hot down.
How did you happen to hear that faint radio message?
Well, it was a radio patch, actually.
Now, what does that consist?
Well, they have a handheld 3-pound unit, and they relay the patch through telephone, through Anchorage radio, and they hook you up direct with the Alaska telephone system.
In other words, the guy on the mountain talks into the radio,
mm-hmm.
and it goes to the Anchorage telephone system.
Yeah.
And then they call you.
Yeah,
you answer,
on our
and
telephone.
You talk to the guy in the mountain through the telephone.
Yeah, also I have the HF radio and a set in each plane to match it. And also at the base station locations around McKinley and where the expedition camps are and at the mountain house on the southeast approach at 6,000 feet. When I have some action out there, I always install a real functional radio or two in case of an emergency.
Okay, now you mentioned these 78 rescue planes.
Yeah.
How did they get to Alaska?
Well, the airlines brought them up free of charge.
Which airline?
I think old Alaska Airlines and Northwest Airlines, in a press of this magnitude, a lot of people are involved. You want to resolve it as fast as you can.
Oh, sure.
And the airline helped by hauling the climbers free, and also Military Air Transport Command, who likewise.
Look at the one that you bring an injured climber down off the mountain, bring a 2-towel heat mat, you say. What is the standard procedure? In other words, you get them to Anchorage right from here?
Well, not always. Seems there's a whole lot of them, like the Ricardo Casina Expedition, where there's 9 of them. I bring them to Talkeetna, and one of our other pilots is meeting me here.
I see.
Or one of our other connections is we try to plan ahead, and sometimes the CAP gives us a tremendous hand. As I mentioned in the Helmut Raphael and Dr. Von Wetzel episode, a helicopter was in this area. We nailed a helicopter down, put him up there, because when we got splints on Orville Engelhorn's legs, he was too big to get in an airplane. The only thing we could do was side load him on a helicopter. Then we thought ahead, and the helicopter had urgent business and was on charter in this area. And so I said, call a Beaver, a CAP Beaver, which they did. And the CAP Beaver was here, and the helicopter transferred Orville into the CAP Beaver, and it worked like butter, and we got him in there less than 4 hours after the accident, clearing the Anchorage Hospital. He was in the emergency care.
Yeah. But in other words, the general procedure is obviously to get to a doctor. Now, you don't have any facilities right here in Talkeetna.
No, but...
is there somebody here in Talkeetna?
Yeah, there's a registered nurse, Mrs. Wolf, is here. And she helps a lot and gives good advice. And also, after you handle about so many people, you know who you can fool and who you can't.
Yeah, right.
There was an automobile wreck over here last fall, and I passed on moving one of the victims, and she died on the way in the helicopter with two flight surgeons trying to keep her alive. But she had broken bones, back, lungs, punctured, and all that. And so,
listen, what do you carry? Now, you said you had medical supplies with you in the plane.
I took along special stuff. When the message come out, we took along oxygen, we took along plasma for blood transfusion, a whole blood. I had even had whole blood besides plasma.
Who supplied it?
I think I'm not supplied. I just deliver the goods, whether it be supplied by the military or by the civilian hospital. People are, if there's something to deliver, I try to deliver.
Well, right, I mean the supply. Who gives it to you to get up to them?
Yeah, well, sometimes in the case of, I'll tell you, of the splints, I'll tell you, this was military. I picked it up at Summit and also picked up a big load of oxygen at Summit. Through the courtesy of the military, the old cancer rescue, search and rescue.
This was for the
day. Yeah, this was military for the
right.
And I recall right now that I picked it up at Summit because it was flown in there in a big plane. The helicopters were coming in, but they hadn't got there. By the time I had left, when I come back, it was ready to go, and they got all screwed up. Yeah, but it could happen to anybody because those clouds shift and you get over the tunnel in between layers and you get lost and you don't watch it.
Yeah. How do you buy instruments down when you get into those multi-layered clouds? How do you...
thing you can do is the best thing anybody can do is stay out of turbulence and clouds and freezing and icing. But the weather to the north, the Tanana Valley, was not as thick as this big layer moving in from the south. So any heading out of there would be north, right? And you go into the area of Nenana and you'd be in broken stuff at 10, 20,000 feet. You could get out of it. So there's no ADFs on McKinley. I've got a radio at the 14-3 that I hope to recover from the Sedan expedition last year. But it's hard to negotiate what you can't see, but if you know that you're on the north heading, that's a true heading of north, variation 27 degrees, you can get away from it. If it gets over your head when you get away from it, you didn't spin in first. It's a big job to get through the layers and on top of some more layers, and then orient yourself. It's real confusing.
I've spent years
around those mountains where you know all the faces, you know all the approaches, you know all the glaciers, just a glimpse of a piece of the glacier, and you're oriented. Well, you have to be. This is the 22nd year.
Right. Okay, I better go.
Yeah.
Okay, Don, look at...
Well, how about 8:30?
That sounds great. We'll be back.
Yeah.
And listen, why don't you get yourself an hour of sleep, man?
Yeah, tired. Oh, yeah. Well, I...
How long have you been going?
Oh. 6.
Is that right?
Yeah, but...
Okay. I guess we're plugged in here. Okay, questions on the Devil's Canyon trip. First of all, where is Devil's Canyon with regard to Talkeetna?
Well, it's about 65 air miles northeast of Talkeetna, it's a big Pacific Canyon.
Okay.
It's confined to a narrow rock gorge.
About 5 miles long.
Huh?
Okay. How long were the group and the boat gone upriver before you spotted the wreckage?
Now, it was the second day.
2 days.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Third question. Where did you land at Curry, on the river?
Yeah.
Okay, so you just pulled in at Curry there and offloaded these guys. Was the military waiting for them there?
No. No, they didn't know the wreck had happened.
Yeah, I see. Okay. And you offloaded them there, and then what, later on, was like, picked them up? Or
no, they sent the
They just
army in there to get
sat
them.
There until the army got okay?
They will be with it.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay, how high are the canyon walls?
Oh, probably 600-800 feet high. That's okay. Go ahead.
All right. Okay. Probably the next thing we want to talk about then is this Helmut Rathel trip.
Yeah.
And,
well, why don't I start from the start of it?
Okay. And like I say, give as much detail as you
yeah,
can.
Yeah, I will.
I think of something as we go along.
Okay.
Okay.
So, anyway, a number of the peaks of the Alaska Range had never been climbed. Matter of fact, prior to 1951, only three major climbs have been accomplished in the whole Alaska Range. Two climbs from the north, northeast approach, Pioneer, Parsons Ridge route, and also one west approach by Dr. Washburn with a team of his own to climb the west approach from the Cahill Glacier. One of the reasons Mount Russell has never been climbed, the mountain is of 12,000 foot elevation, but it's the home of the winds. It's not too far from Farewell on the northwest side of the range. And big pressure exchanges of the polar air on the north and the marine tropical air itself as they rush over landward from the south and the east and the Bristol Bay from the west and southwest collide these masses of various airs of different temperatures and pressures collide over the top of the Alaska Range, especially in the western quadrant in the area of Mount Russell. And of course, tremendous winds with velocities in excess of 100 miles an hour sweep over these peaks. And this is one of the reasons, in addition to the remoteness of the mountains, that Mount Russell was never before climbed. And Helmut Rathel, one of the great climbing old timers of Europe, from Germany, and an expedition of eight German climbers and one American climber, planned for about a year, and then they arrived on the scene. As I recall, it was in June, about, 61 thereabouts, and their objective was the northwest ridge of Mount Russell.
Is there any way we can get the date pinned down a little closer than that now?
Oh, yeah.
Because,
I'll get the date.
You know, if I'm going to write that in, it's got to be exact.
Anyway, the team arrived by the Alaska Railroad train, and I met the team, and we had favorable weather, and we made immediate headway to the shutter down, if you know.
Listen,
so anyway, I met the crew at the train. We had good weather. We proceeded to the northwest approach of Mount Russell under fair skies, but ominous southwesterly wind.
Now, how many trips did it take you in?
Well, I had a tremendous pile of stuff. I think I made. There were eight passengers, and I had about 1,250 pounds of freight, so I made four trips. Now, this is the eight passengers who fell, had the doctor, Von Wetzel, who came in 3 days later. But anyway, during the time that we used to land the three loads, the weather was fair. I was taking off from the downwind conditions, but it was only 20 mile an hour downwind takeoff, which is normal. In a empty just on the back of a ski. Anyway, as I came in with the fourth load, the tremendous winds from the southwest had blown in an overcast, and it was a question of whether to return to Talkeetna with the load, big freight load of hardware and food, or to make a landing. And I elected to negotiate a landing in the face of about a 40 mile an hour cross headwind from the southwest, which was going overcasting. And we quickly unloaded the load, and the wind thundered in over the tops of the peaks. And I looked up just in time to see a tremendous blast of wind rip off some cornices on the high peak of the West Approach, Mount Russell. And pieces 4 or 5 feet in diameter were tearing off to the roots, big blocks of ice and cornice. And a terrible gale was moving in, and I was sitting there on the face of the glacier to 6,000 foot level, and I'm about to negotiate a downwind takeoff in the wind's gusty 40 mile an hour velocity better. Now, if you take off to the stalling speed of 60 miles an hour, you have to, of course, get 60 miles an hour in relation to your relative airspeed to the ground in order to make the wing fly. Now, if you have a 40 or a 50 mile an hour tailwind, you have to overcome this velocity of the wind in order to retain your 60 mile an hour relative airflow over the wings in order to make the airplane fly. In other words, you have to be flying in excess of 100 miles an hour.
That's ground speed.
You'd be traveling over the ice in excess of 100 miles an hour before the plane would fly, because here you have the simple problem of 45 mile an hour gust and tailwinds, which might even raise your ice takeoff speed to 115 to 120 miles an hour. So,
John, is that hard on, obviously that's been hard on you.
Well, it is, because of the crevasses and rocks and ice holes and uneven surfaces that skip around until you get the velocity. So finally, after about a 3/4 mile run down the glacier empty with a brand new airplane, I was able to negotiate takeoff. And made a slow turn and climbed into the wind and climbed to 14,000 feet at the rate of about 5,000 feet a minute. And my objective was to go over the Cahilton Pass, which is 11,000 feet clearance.
So this is 180 now?
Yeah, brand new 180.
That was right.
So, Holly, see who's at the door. Leave the window alone. So, as I climbed, no problem to get to 14,000 feet, and I headed out over Cahilton Pass southbound. The tremendous force and velocity, the wind whistling through the pass, exceeded my airspeed. And I found that I was holding my own, and then I was losing ground. And I pointed the airplane down to the red line airspeed of 192 miles an hour, and I found myself still drifting backward through the pass, and luckily it was smooth air. So then I did a 180 degree turn, and I went to Minchuman and waited for 8 hours for the winds to cool down.
Let me ask you a couple quick questions. First of all, don't let me forget to get the date of these climbs.
Yeah, well, this must have been in 62.
Okay. Now, how about a description of Rafael?
Oh!
Let's do that.
Well,
I can write about the guy, convention.
Yeah. Well, Rafael.
Where was he from?
Germany.
From Germany.
Of course. He was an old line in Germany. And he was a Prussian soldier.
You know what town in Germany?
Well, I could hopefully look it up if it really necessary.
Well, it isn't.
Anyway, but it was from deep Germany. He spoke with, of course, heavy accent, and he was stately and tall, and in his battles, he carried some scars from the early World War I, probably. He was minus, I believe, his right eye, and had saber marks on both cheeks, and he used to fight with sabers, you see. As a matter of fact, he was pretty well battle scarred, but he's recognized as one of the great climbing talents of Europe, all Europe. And he wanted to make one last stand and climb one mountain that nobody had ever been able to penetrate to the top. And, well, I should say he was an old school Prussian soldier, and he was way more than that. He was probably 60 years old at the time,
right.
Yeah, but he's still a good athlete.
Yeah, right.
He walked straight as a die and had a manner of authority.
When you took these guys in, Don, what glacier did you land on?
Well, there's a glacier on the northwest approach of Rust, and we could look it on the map and get a name for sure. I just looked until I got a suitable landing place and landed.
Okay.
Anyway, I can relocate the landing location and find a name.
We'll have to get the dates on.
Okay, so then 3 days or thereabouts later, the storm abated, and on the following day, I met a train, and the physician for the expedition, Von Wetzel, was to be on this train this particular day. And I watched the passengers train and come off the platform there. And then all of a sudden, here is another giant of a Prussian soldier. And this one has a huge handlebar mustache. He's about 6 foot six or taller. A rich, stately figure of a man. He's got two huge, beat up, battered medical satchels, one in each hand, and here he comes. He's wearing a monocle, I think he's in left eye, and he's strictly sauerkraut, fresh from Germany, and he's a sight to behold. So I rushed up to him and I did say, "Sir, you must be Von Wetzel, the doctor." And he squinted his monocle at me and he says, "Young man, what you need is sleep alone." And little did he know that when the mountain socked in, I was on a hard schedule, day and night flying.
You were flying even though they...
I was flying the float plane into the mines and to the new mines located over in the Alaska Range. And I've been getting by on 2 hours of sleep a night for about a month. So he thought it was a shock work case. And he was probably right. I have bloodshot eyes, I'm underweight about 30 pounds, and running around trying to make all these connections. So that was a shock to me, and we both laughed when he told me I needed sleep alone. So he misdiagnosed my case. There, I had the plane ready and gassed up, and the weather once again was fair, and we departed within 25 or 30 minutes for the rest of the expedition location on the northwest ridge of Mount Wetzel. So we were about 45 miles northwest of Talkeetna, flying in an aircraft 29 Tango is the number. 9239 Tango, the two Cessna. And I always listened to the high frequency band, the carrier band that all the bush routes talk plane to plane, and also contact ground to plane and plane to ground on position reports and emergencies. And all of a sudden, there was a tremendous scramble on the air. And an excited voice on the 3411 band said, "Anybody listening, we have big emergency here at a construction camp 45 miles north of Calcutta, at the Troublesome Creek Area Camp. And I, as I was listening, I come back and I said, this is 3-9 Tango. We're about 40 miles west of your position. What happened? And they said, well, one of our cat skinners was bulldozing stumps and trees, and the head of the bulldozer, he saw a brand new chainsaw carelessly left by one of the tree fallers. So he leaped off his cat, his big D9 cat he was driving, went over in the timber to pick up the chainsaw that he'd seen, a brand new Chinese chainsaw. I think it was sitting on top of a stump. And as he leaned over to pick it up, the second bulldozer just flat, ran right over the top of him.
You didn't see it coming?
It was from behind.
Yeah.
His own cat was left running, and his other cat took a swatch, not seeing him, because of the huge blade. And as he went to pick the chainsaw off on the top of this stump, he was just flat by the bulldozer. And I said, is he still alive? He said, yes, it looks like he's still alive. And he's bleeding from a thousand places. Brush burned, and his legs are broken, and his pelvis is broken, but he's still breathing. So I said to Von Wetzel, I said, Dr. Von Wetzel, there's a terrible emergency at this construction camp. It would be suitable if you would take time to see if you could go save the man's life. And Von Wetzel says, yeah, he says, we affects him up. So we detoured, flew back to 40 miles, and we landed on the sandbar with this new Cessna on retractable skis.
What were these guys doing in there, Don?
They were clearing the road to Fairbanks. Fairbanks.
Uh-huh.
And construction camp on road gang. So we made a successful landing on a ice-covered sandbar near Troublesome Creek Camp. And we rushed over there, but we could see where the accident had happened. And I was able to land about 500 yards from the accident. And we rushed over there, and Von Wetzel splinted the victim's legs with the spruce trees. I helped cut the spruce trees and drive them. And he also splinted his arms. And then we made a discovery. I rushed back to the plane and called for a helicopter. I had one in the area, and luckily we was able to intercept him. Anyway, the helicopter arrived, and then we called and radioed ahead and got a Civil Air Patrol vehicle to wait here in Calcutta for the arrival of the helicopter. And less than 4 hours from the time of the accident, the victim, the mobile, was on the operating table in Anchorage. Anyway, he was badly crushed from his toes to his pelvis, and he was really mauled by this D9 caterpillar that fell over the top. Anyway, 6 months later, I had another hospital victim, and through the emergency, I had a car in town, and I sometimes the red wagon was busy, usually they're available, but sometimes you catch a call and they say it'll be a half hour delay on the red wagon. So I had my own car in this particular case. I went down this other hospital case directly to the emergency ward, and I went on in to the hospital, and who should I see? This is now 6 months later, after I've taken England on in. Or I had rather
taken in, right?
Yeah, Von Wetzel undoubtedly saved his life on the spot and was bled to death overriding. And he splinted him up, but they didn't have to improve on his sets, his leg sets. His bones were crushed, but his sets on some of the things were perfect. So they just cast his bones without any further traction. Surgeon. But anyway, as I, 6 months later, looked around the corner, here should go a victim of the caterpillar accident, or Molino one, down the hallway, and I whistled at him, and he stopped, and I say, what was the worst part of that old ordeal? And he says, I was in excruciating pain. He said, I felt pressed, my big toes and hurt my pelvis. I heard all over. And he said, the worst part of the whole thing was just before you guys got there with that German doctor. He says, the cook rushed out with a fifth of scotch and poured it down my throat, and I hate scotch.
Well, Don, what about the climb itself? They went on and were successful?
Yeah, three out of the nine. One American and two Germans. The rest of the Germans supported.
Now, you said nine. That's a total group.
Yeah.
That's including Van Wetzel, including Rethel.
The doctor and Rethel.
There's a total of nine in the group.
Yeah.
Remember any names?
Yeah, I just mentioned one.
The one would be on there.
I don't know.
Okay.
Let's see. No, I don't. I remember the German names outside of the two. But, Bob Goodwin was one of the American climbers. He was an engineer. So I took an engineer to figure out way up in northwest.
Yeah. Job. Was he from Seattle area?
No, he's from the Alyeska area.
Oh.
But anyway, it was the first climb, and there's been a lot of first climbs. There's probably, I should list them. Primary first climbs. Now, Blesser, the old Blesser climbed the south face of Mount Voyager, and that was one endurance contest that nobody ever heard about, except it's a record climb. It's about 5-6 years ago. That's almost like climbing the south face of McKinley, not quite as high, not quite as steep a place. But tremendous